Good afternoon. Thanks for being here. So I'd like to share some of my research with biochar amended substrates. I've been working with both seed germination and also cutting adventitious root development at Cal Poly. And this is a small snapshot of some of the work I've been doing, looking primarily at the root development of cuttings on these amended substrates. So I teach classes related to plant propagation, and I conduct research as well at Cal Poly, though technically my contract is 100% teaching. I still find time for research in there somewhere. So I travel around California and talk to growers as well as part of my job to find out what they're doing and what techniques they're using, what materials they're using. And I've been hearing a similar story recently, and I'm sure it's not confined to California. And that is that many of the components of substrates and mixes that growers are using are going up in price. They're getting quite expensive. And for growers that deal with retail customers or sometimes even wholesale customers, there is an interest in ecological responsibility. And they'll talk about, most growers I find don't want to talk about the word sustainability a lot, but they want to have something that appeals to the consumer that it is responsibly sourced, right, on ingredients. So this slide shows some of the cost of perlite over time, how it has been increasing. This is based on the USGS mineral commodity summary. This does not translate directly to the cost that a grower is going to see, but there is a very close relationship between this and the bill that a grower will see. Once the cost of ingredient goes up, it's much easier to make a case to a grower to start considering alternative materials. So as we look at peat being harvested in California, we've had somewhat of a peat shortage this year, where if you did not commit to buy early, some growers were facing a difficulty of obtaining peat. And the concept of using things like biochars has raised interest. One of the interesting things about biochar is some growers will try it, plants will die, and they'll say it's terrible stuff, stay away from it, right? Don't touch it. Other growers will come and ask questions about what can I expect from it? Does it act like perlite or vermiculite or peat or core? How does it behave in a substrate? What does it do? What are its properties? Well, biochar is a very diverse substance. For any of you in the room that have studied it or worked with it or just read about it a little bit, you're fully aware of that. If you haven't, be aware that biochar is very complex, right? It's something that is not simple. It's kind of like saying you're getting a car, right? There's a lot of variability. You might be getting a sports car. You might be getting an SUV. You might be getting a truck. There's lots of variability in a car. Well, biochar, you have some organic material that's gone through pyrolysis, and then it's intended to be incorporated into a soil or a substrate. That's the definition of biochar, right? Very simply. But depending upon the temperature of pyrolysis, what the feedstock material is, and how it is handled post-pyrolysis, the physical and chemical properties can vary greatly, to the point of sometimes can be toxic to plant material, other times be very favorable. You might change the water-holding capability of the biochar. So to just use the term biochar, it's a very loose term and one that has a very large amount of variability. If you think of the word soil, right? If you just say you're growing in soil, you want to ask questions about that. What is your soil type? The picture on this slide, the picture on the slide right here of these particles, those are particles from the biochar that I worked with, which I will describe in a little more detail in just a second. So that's an example of some of the particles. In my study, I had to select some plant material to work with as well as I wanted to work with cuttings. I selected 7 herbaceous species, and it was based on the ability to buy unrooted cuttings. That was one of my factors, and also ones that were being produced by growers that I was speaking to. So I kept a list of plants they were growing and tried to target species that were being rooted relatively close by. So these are the 7 species that I worked with. I'm not going to dwell on them long because their names are not that important to this research, and so I'm going to move on instead of dwelling on those for a long period of time. But they are all ornamental herbaceous species, right, that we're looking at. And all of these species, most growers are going to root without any added plant hormone. So they're going to generally not be applying a lot of extra IBA or other forms of auxin. So my study objective was to look at herbaceous cutting rooting in substrates that were amended with a biochar. I decided I needed to be more specific than just saying biochar, and so the biochar that was supplied to me by Bay Area Biochar was a coconut shell biochar. So that's what my research is centered around, working with coconut shell biochar. And the design of the experiment was something like this. So I worked with a 2-to-1 sphagnum peat moss and coarse perlite base mix. And so that was my control that had 0% amendment. And then I added on a volume basis, either 10%, 20%, 40%, or 80% biochar, the coconut shell biochar that I was working with. So this biochar was made from coconut shells. It underwent pyrolysis at approximately 600 degrees Celsius. It was set So we were talking about the biochar. It was ground to a coarse fine particle, I should say. It would be classified as a coarse powder by the designation by CAMS-Harbestian. If you're interested in that classification system, talk to me afterwards. I can talk about it in a little more detail. And it was acidified so that the pH was around 6.4. And when I tested it, that's what it came out as. That's what the claim was by the producer. So an example of what these experiments look like in the greenhouse, the picture in the lower right-hand corner, they were laid out in a randomized complete block design. In the first time I ran the experiment, I had a replication of 15. So each cutting species had 15 cuttings at each substrate treatment. And the second time I did the experiment, I dropped the replication down to 10. So each species had 10 replicates in the second experiment. When I collected data, what I was looking at on these particular plants was one, a root rating or a rooting rating. This would be basically the take of a grower, looking at this with a subjective scale. But the core question is this plant acceptable for transplant? So my scale ran, 0 was a dead cutting, 1 was alive but no root formation, 2 was alive with minimal root formation, it'd often be 1 very small root. 3 had beyond that 1 root development, but it was not acceptable for transplanting. 4 would be okay for transplanting, but not ideal. And then 5 at the top of the scale is an ideal cutting. So there's an element of subjectivity to that rooting rating scale. Primary root count, primary root length, and root two-dimensional area were all accomplished right after the plants were handled. So I washed the roots, as you can see on the right side of the screen. They would come out very clean. It was very easy to get them clean. Then I would excise all the roots on that cutting onto a overhead transparency sheet that was on a scanner, and then scan the sheet. So what you're seeing here on the left is the scan of all the excised roots from one cutting. And then on the right is it after processing with ImageJ. So I went through a process where I would enhance the contrast and then reduce down to a mask and then analyze for the area. And then I could generate a count of individual objects. And the primary root length I did by manual tracing. There are other formulations you can do for that, but I used manual tracing for my primary root length data collection. So the results of the study, they were diverse, as you might expect, with 7 different species and 2 replicates of the experiment. They didn't all look alike. But there was a general trend that emerged in my research, and that is depicted here in the responses of Ajuga, where we see on the far left-hand side of the screen is the control. And we have a few roots that formed, but they were very long and highly developed roots. As you move across to the upper levels of the biochar amendment, you have more roots. Oops, sorry, that just jumped. We have more roots, but they are quite short in length. So that trend was not always that clear in the results, but the overall results were increasing number of roots, but shorter root lengths as you move up the biochar amendment levels. So if we're looking at the rooting ratings, this is a lot to process at once. The big picture, though, if you're looking at that dark bar, the very darkest bar on the right side of each cluster of values, you'll notice that the highest level of biochar amendment generally resulted in a lower rooting rating than the lower amounts of biochar in the adventitious root formation in evaluation. At times, the control was up at the top of the scale. Other times, some biochar inclusion was beneficial for the root development of the plant. This is a close-up of a cutting at the highest biochar level of amendment. And what we see there is this cluster of short roots that were highly branched. So there were a large amount of roots generally at the highest rate of biochar. This picture here depicts, once again, the very similar to what I talked about before, and you saw in the picture with the ajuga. This is with phlox, where we have a control plant that has very long root establishment, and then one at the higher rate of biochar, 80%, with shorter roots that are more densely branched. So as I was looking at this and trying to draw summaries or interpret the data that I was seeing, a two-dimensional area was very helpful to interpret that. So this is the two studies, or the 2 years that I ran the study, combining that data, because year was not a significant factor, and looking at the two-dimensional root area of all the cuttings. So what you'll see is for some plants, for instance, right here with Leucanthemum, we have this low level of biochar produced a very large response, not significantly different from 0%, 10, or 20%. As soon as you get up to 40 and 80, you have a drop in the root area. With some plants, there's a similar pattern, like salvia right here, where the 10% has significantly higher response. Others, like Acalia over here, is not significant in the differences. Same with Iberis, no significant differences. So the conclusion that I drew from this round of research is that, one, with the results that I saw, up to 20%, there were no harmful effects that were significant in the study. So something growers will ask me is, will this harm my plant, or will this harm the plant I'm growing? I could answer, with this particular product, no, you're not going to do damage to the species that I tested up to the rate of 20%. What I saw with the highest rate is that I had more number of primary roots, but the roots were relatively short, so there seemed to be a reduction in size. So this leads to a follow-up point, or a follow-up question, and that is, was the reduction in root length caused by chemical or physical properties? As I look at the way the plant grew, the way the root system grew, was that due to something in that biochar that was chemical, or was it due to the fact that the particles were smaller in that biochar substrate, and that led to a change in the growth response of my cuttings? So I'm just getting ready to launch a follow-up study where I have sand particles that are very similar to my biochar particles, and I'm going to test that to see if, with sand sitting in the role of the biochar, do I get the same differences in root structure on the plant. Biochar particle size and pyrolysis are very important, and so one thing that I've stressed anytime I talk to growers or people that are thinking about using biochar is that they are not all the same, and that it's very important to understand what its chemical and physical properties are before you use it. In this research, it was funded by the California Association of Nurseries and Garden Centers and the Agricultural Research Institute. I want to thank Chris Wassenberg, Pamela Crane Hoover, and Sarah Doe for technical assistance throughout the study. And I'd like to use my remaining time to invite any questions you might have about what I've done. There we go. Okay, so the question was, did I use any hormones for rooting? The answer is no, I didn't. These were all species that I selected because most commercial growers that I talked to did not tend to use hormones with them. I didn't want that added complication. I did do more research that I'm not presenting here at this conference, but it was coming very soon, and that is using applied hormones, both as liquid and as talc, in biochars to see if there's any kind of situation there. But, yeah, not in this study. Yes. Yes. So the question was, one of my goals was to look at whether or not the plant would be transplantable, and did I see differences in that? Some of the high levels of biochar, the end result was consistently not ready for transplanting. So the root system was too small for transplanting at that time. I suspect it would have been okay down the road with more time, but it was just a slower root development that was happening in that substrate. In my data collection, it was all destructive, so the plants were dead at the end, so I wasn't able to actually transplant any, but that's a good question. Yes. It was taken in the rating, so a 0 would be a dead cutting and a 1 would be alive but no rooting. And there were almost no plants with that category. They all produced at least one root. They were a very, very few, but almost no failure to root, which with the 7 species I was growing, you would expect those to root. They're pretty easy to grow.